Welcome to the Community Wealth Canada podcast. I'm Colin Brusanthus. One of the most significant aspects of community wealth building is its approach to the subject of procurement. Each year, our public and nonprofit anchor institutions, our schools, hospitals, local governments, cultural and religious institutions, purchase many billions of dollars worth of goods and services from outside organizations. By examining where and from whom these purchases are made, it becomes possible to stop our money from disappearing into the offshore tax havens of the few and get it circulating through our communities. In Cleveland, progressive procurement not only increased local investment, but helped develop the Evergreen Cooperatives, democratic, worker-owned companies in a deeply underprivileged neighborhood. Over the last 15 years, starting with a cooperative laundry, the Evergreen Cooperatives have grown to a workforce of several hundred employees, making significantly above industry averages. Today we're speaking with Stephanie McHenry. Stephanie is the Chief Executive Officer at the Democracy Collaborative, the think and do tank that developed the concept of community wealth building. Stephanie has also held a very long list of leadership roles in Cleveland, where it all began. Stephanie, welcome.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Why don't you begin by telling us about the Democracy Collaborative? What does it mean to be a think and do tank?
Well, we have spent about 20 years thinking about alternatives to unfettered capitalism when it comes to communities being able to generate wealth for itself and for its citizens. So it started, as an academic exercise and has blossomed into a think and do tank in the sense that we've been involved in some demonstration projects starting in Cleveland to show that our theories about the control of capital and who controls it and the ownership of enterprises can make a difference in economic equity in various communities, especially those that have been underinvested.
You're talking about the tale of two cities that we see in so many communities that are often rooted in very troubling histories.
That's right. That's right. Everything from redlining that's very well documented here in our city that kept people away from home ownership, which is so often the basis of wealth creation here in the United States. People of color were intentionally by the federal government not allowed to participate in accumulating wealth in that way for many years, ranging to lack of opportunity for businesses to start and to do business with the larger enterprises that are here historically. So, that all makes for a mix of underinvested neighborhoods. And if I can just say, I think that it's kind of ironic that the Democracy Collaborative has been, telling the story for a couple of decades now. And we have now arrived at a time where more people see it between what happened with COVID that exposed a lot of inequities. What we've seen with violence against people of color by police and others, all of a sudden people agree, oh, you're right. We can't just keep doing things the way we've been doing it and get the kinds of outcomes that we ultimately want to have. So this, I feel like this is our moment to really accelerate what we're doing.
Absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about how the ball started to get rolling in Cleveland?
Sure. The Cleveland project started as seeking solutions for neighborhoods like we just talked about. At that time in Cleveland's history, we had had something of a bit of a renaissance when it came to downtown. The stadiums had moved downtown, within the last 10 years of the major athletic stadium. So there was some vibrancy going on there. Of course, University Circle, the neighborhood surrounding where the laundry started, was prospering because that's where the large arts institutions, the orchestra and the arts museum, as well as major anchor institutions, two major hospitals, a major university, were all thriving sort of right next door. So, but the people living in the adjoining neighborhood of Glenville had a different story. At that time, the neighborhood of Glenville was receiving more people formerly incarcerated, I think, than any other zip code in the state of Ohio. So we had that big issue going on. There was chronic unemployment. So those residents were not enjoying the benefits of all the economic prosperity that was all surrounding them. So a couple smart people, including co-founder Ted Howard and some really, progressive and committed people at the Cleveland Foundation, like India Pierce Lee, decided that, they needed to partner to create a solution because the traditional economic development solutions were not bringing jobs into the region or into that part of the region, and certainly not providing support for the neighborhood. So the basic concept was, how do we use money that's already being spent, money that's already going out of the door somewhere, and redirect that into neighborhoods that could use those resources and that investment? So the one obvious answer was the hospitals, right? So what do hospitals buy a lot of that we could potentially provide? But we weren't going to turn into a pharmaceutical company overnight, right? And we probably weren't going to turn into a medical school overnight. But what about laundry? Hospitals do a lot of laundry. And that felt like an industry without huge barriers to entry. It felt like it would fit with the idea of being able to bring people in as employees and sort of train them up in a not impossible industry to learn. So that's how they landed. That was the basic concept. How do we capitalize on the money that the hospitals are spending to provide jobs and commerce in the next door neighborhood?
And that actually turned into a bit of a network of anchor institutions, didn't it?
Yes. I mean, certainly as you're starting an enterprise, you don't ever want to just have like the one customer, right? So even though we started at the hospital level because we knew that there was revenue there, we wanted to diversify. So I believe Case Western Reserve got in on it, and then some of the facilities outside of the immediate university circle area, some of the other medical facilities also got in the act. And it was a startup enterprise, Colin. So you have to go out and find people to buy what you're selling. So that's exactly the approach that was taken. I failed to say, I implied it, but I didn't say explicitly that the Cleveland Foundation made investments in this endeavor. We could not have started without some charitable dollars coming to the table to take a risk on getting the enterprise up and running. So that's a very important component as well.
Let's talk a bit about the enterprise itself, because this was a different business model. It was not a standard top-down corporate model. This was an inclusive ownership model.
Yes. Yeah, so, inclusive ownership was a key component here, because we not only wanted to have people have reasonable wages, good wages, to support themselves and support their families, we wanted to address the equity piece, right? So with unfettered capitalism, equity flows where capital flows, right? So if you have enough money to buy into an enterprise, and then you get to buy in. But if for all kinds of reasons you don't have those dollars, how do you ever get a piece of the pie? So we wanted to use sweat equity and commitment to the neighborhood and to the business as ways of entry for individuals who otherwise would not have been able to participate from an equity perspective. And that has its that had its challenges, because what does that really mean? Does that mean that everybody's the boss, right? Or does that mean that I get to do whatever I want to do anytime? No, we all had to grow up and learn what that actually meant. But I'm very pleased to say that I know in the last couple years, we've had the first round of folks that started way back then be able to start to retire. And not only did they get their pensions or their retirement benefits, a lot of them got, five-figure checks that was part of the equity that they had earned in the organization over that time. And that can be a real life changer for a lot of families.
Yeah, you're talking about a level of transformation that I think many of us don't even think about right now. We've gotten so used to neoliberal decay that when we see an underprivileged neighborhood, we tend to think it's going to stay that way for a long time. But you're talking about, in a very grounded way, you're talking about replication, not starting from scratch, but reigniting a sense of imagination as to what might actually be possible.
Yeah, I mean, we want to get to the root causes. Unfortunately, many times, certainly here in America, people assume that you're doing bad because you're not smart enough, you're not industrious enough. It's somehow your fault, right? And once that's accepted and that low expectation, really takes root, then people do assume that there's nothing to do about it, but just keep sort of throwing money at the symptoms. I mean, what we at the Democracy Collaborative have done for decades is to say, let's look at the root causes. Let's look at the systemic, intentional things that have happened to people in neighborhoods. And let's use some reasonably understandable and common structures like employee ownership, like cooperatives. You know, credit unions have existed for a long time, and that's a cooperative model. So we aren't pulling these crazy models out of the air and say, this is what we have to do to turn capitalism absolutely upside down through these foreign, you know, these foreign structures. We're saying, let's use what have been used in various settings, but let's combine those and concentrate those and have a place-based focus and an intentionality around benefiting certain people.
Right. It's an empowering notion to think we don't need to start from scratch. We actually have models that allow us to address these historically ingrained problems and to get to, as you say, right to the root of those problems. So to recap, we have early support from the Cleveland Foundation to help develop worker cooperatives in an underprivileged neighborhood, marginalized neighborhood. These cooperatives are developing, producing services that are needed in that community. They're viable enterprises with inclusive ownership. We have procurement from the anchor institutions, making those more viable enterprises and getting some cash flowing into the underprivileged neighborhoods. And the culmination of this is that people are actually retiring with dignity and amassing a good quality of life for themselves.
Right. And another very important factor is you get dollars recirculating in that community. So with an extractive model, you know, the money is made in the enterprise, and then that money flows right back out to, you know, to whoever has ownership or whoever, and that could get spent anywhere. Right. Many of the people that earn those dollars and earn that equity in Glenville spent the money in Glenville. Mm-hmm. They invested in housing in Glenville. They shopped in Glenville. So you also have the multiplier of when you keep assets closer to home, that creates even more wealth than just that individual family.
That's a brilliant point. It's not just investment. It's reinvestment and reinvestment.
That's right.
I understand that there is also now an employee ownership fund that has come out of the Evergreen Cooperatives to help workers in companies with retiring entrepreneurs, companies that are at risk of shutting down, the workers are going to lose their jobs, the community is going to lose community pillars, and to actually help the workers purchase those companies, take them under worker control, and make them worker cooperatives as well.
That's right. That's right. And I'm not the expert on it, but I know a little bit, just enough to be dangerous. But the idea, is that often, I am a recovering banker, so I do understand this part about it. Often it's difficult to finance cooperative organizations because the bank doesn't know where to put the lien, right? If there's one owner or two owners, then you know, you can tie them up and know that you have that extra layer of security for the loan. But if there's 100 owners, you know, what do you do? How do you secure that? So it's important to have alternative finance opportunities and on the equity side as well. I mean, you get the same sort of accountability quandary on the equity side. You know, that venture capitalist wants to know who can I come beat up on if this doesn't work? And if it's 100 people, that's a lot harder than if it's one or two.
Right.
So it was important to create a structure that would help businesses not only start, but also convert. I think there's real power in conversion. One of the things that I think is a big opportunity for, especially around the Midwest, is there are a lot of enterprises that are where the owners are reaching retirement age, but don't necessarily have an apparent heir. Plus, as you know, there are tax benefits for selling your business to your employees. So you know, having the funding piece added to all those other incentives to sell to employees, I think was very smart on their part.
Absolutely. And it's fascinating to see how once the ball gets rolling with community wealth building, it becomes possible to have a much more systemic approach that allows some of these problems, like retiring entrepreneurs, to actually be turned into opportunities like that.
That's right. And you're retaining community members, too. You're retaining population, which is important. A city like Cleveland, when I came in the mid-90s, you know, we were over 1 million people. And we've seen just a steady ticking away of population, and a lot of it had to do with the old extracting economy, where at one point we probably had a dozen corporate headquarters here, and now we're down to less than a handful. So when the corporates left, the people left. This new way of thinking about building local economy has a built-in loyalty to place, because you know you're building it based on what's happening in the place and things that are likely not to move. You know, right. Ergo anchor institutions. You know, the hospitals can't move to the next lowest wage place and still do what they're supposed to do, right? Universities tend not to pick up and move. So the whole structure is really place-based in its nature. And that becomes a very important retention opportunity.
Well, that's so critical, because right now we are living in an economy that is rapidly becoming more precarious. And again, that's something that many people take for granted as a continuing trend. But you're talking about going in the other direction.
That's right. You know, look at the assets, understand what they are, and then, you know, treat them as precious as they are to that community. Extraction goes to the next lowest bidder or the next highest price with no sense of loyalty or no sense of damage even that's done when those moves happen. A place-based strategy that capitalizes on local assets for local people is much more sustainable, in my view.
You've already spoken to many of the different issues that this model addresses, but there is one other that was ingrained in the Evergreen cooperatives from the very outset, which was the use of much more environmentally friendly technologies. Can you speak to how this model allows communities to have more autonomy to deal with the threat of the climate crisis?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's even worse in places, Rust Belt places like Cleveland, where we've already been so abused from an environmental perspective, you know, between the dumping of waste and lead paint in houses. I mean, there's so much damage done to the community through that type of behavior. So when you're concerned about place and your investment is about place, then you want that to be a healthy place, right? So that becomes one of the criteria for how you do business. And you may have an even deeper understanding of that because you've had to chase companies to get places remediated, or you've had to spend tax dollars to try to even make, you know, land and spaces usable. So you understand the negative impact of not doing things in an environmentally sound way. So it becomes a very legitimate factor to be taken into account when you're thinking about how to run that enterprise.
What do you think has been the biggest challenge to work through in order to get this functioning at the level that it is today?
Well, the biggest one, and I think about this a lot, and it's something we don't talk about enough. The system that is in place, a lot of people are making money just like it is. Wouldn't change a thing, right? So even though this all makes sense and you and I are having a great conversation and it seems just crystal clear, what we have on the other side are people who are going to lose. And so you see that in things like procurement, right? So I wish I could tell you that we walked into all the local hospitals and did one 10-minute pitch and they just said, yep, we'll do it. We'll take it right now. It's going to take a lot more convincing, a lot more structure to really have institutions make fundamental change like we're describing in purchasing, and have that be rewarded and have that be, you know, expected in terms of performance versus just getting the easiest, lowest price, no risk perceived because I've been doing business with the supplier for 50 years. So I think resistance to change is a huge one. And how you fix that, I mean, I think we have to be able to describe the overall benefit for the whole community. You know, and there's room. It's not that you have to replace your, you know, very best vendor that, you know, has proprietary technology that only they can do. There's a lot of suppliers way below that, way around that. You know, there's always some set of vendors that you're not quite happy with anyway.
My next question actually builds upon that a little bit, the idea of being able to explain the benefits to the entire community, because community wealth building often starts a little differently and from a different source in one community than another. So if you were speaking to, let's say, a grassroots organizer versus somebody who's already perhaps in government, would you give different advice about how to get a foot in the door, how to get the ball rolling?
Well, I think the organizer's job is to help the community see itself as having assets and understand what's happening to their assets, right? That because this all just sort of happens in the world. You know, we're not always conscious of what's going on or why our community looks like it looks or what the impact of an extractive economy is. So I see the organizer's job largely to help people understand that these are issues that are not accidental. These are issues that have been created, and that there are solutions to them. It's not inevitable that economies have to operate in this way. If I were a municipality or a government, I think what I would emphasize is that, again, this is preserving your assets. You know, this is a way to keep the value of your assets local. And who wouldn't want to do that? I think also helping governments understand their power, their own spending power included, right? A lot of money gets spent by municipalities. And so, you know, they not only can believe and cheerlead, but they can also be a direct part of the solution and even example, you know, here's how we're spending our dollars and here's what the impact has been. And to be able to point to examples where there has been improvement in people's lives. I think painting those two pictures is what I would advise.
How about people who are getting ready to dip their toes in, who are getting ready to start community wealth building in their community? What would be some good resources on things like anchor institutions and procurement practices that they can turn to?
Well, certainly what you're doing is wonderful, spreading the word, you know, and I think fortunately, that the term community wealth building is being used more and more. And, you know, we're building networks. We at the Democracy Collaborative are directly engaged in building networks of practitioners. So certainly come to us, you know, go to our website and Neil McEnroy and Sarah McKinley are our two aces on that, and can point you in some very clear direction. I think just being aware, you know, just, you know, Google it, for lack of better advice, and you'll be surprised how often this is going on in how many different places. You know, chances are you're going to find something that looks similar to your community that you can then engage directly.
I think you hit the nail on the head when you said these things seem like they just happen. I know for me, the first time I thought about anchor institutions and procurement was when I could see it being productively applied in Cleveland. And I think the examples that you've laid out for a lot of people today are going to clarify not just what's going wrong, but what could be going right instead. So Stephanie McHenry, I want to thank you so much for being here and speaking so eloquently on such an important subject.
So thank you for your questions. I really enjoyed the time we spent together.
And thank you for tuning in. If you'd like to support this podcast financially, 10% of all donations will be earmarked for grants to help Canadians develop new worker-owned cooperatives. Stay well.